Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast.
Welcome back to Bookbound. I'm Jessica Trotter. I'm joined at the mic by Marisa Garza and Cheryl Lindemann. And then we have a guest today. Mark Neese is back with us. And we're ready to talk books and welcome.
Yes, we are.
Discussion yes. and...
So we've had Mark on a couple times now, I think two others, and yeah. Mark is part of our technical services team at the library, and technical services is one of those departments that a lot of people don't know exists.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's sort of like that hidden department behind the scenes. We don't do any public service or very little, and what we do is get the books purchased, acquired, processed, cataloged, and out to the branches. And so Mark is a cataloger. I think he's talked about that briefly when we had him on before. But I think one of the things that is unique to Mark's job that even isn't in Madi and Jessica and my job as the selectors, collection development specialist, is that we're purchasing for our areas, we read reviews, we see books, but Mark is seeing a cross-section of everything that is purchased, right? All genres, yep. All ages, so you have so much stuff that you could potentially put on hold.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know whether this is intentional or unintentional, but I've had this strategy this year that if I see anything that looks vaguely interesting, I'm going to put a hold on it and just see what happens.
Yeah.
That's kind
of neat. I'm batting like almost 1,000 this year. It's
awesome.
Pretty amazing. Yeah, I know. It's stunning.
Yeah.
Like pretty much every book that I see and I think, well, that looks pretty interesting, put a hold on it, comes in, and occasionally I'll think, I don't remember putting it on this.
Absolutely.
What is this?
But I'll read it anyway, and it's turned out really well.
That's so,
so far.
Cool. So, yeah. It's so fun.
It's very neat.
And I think in a way our users can have a similar experience by just browsing our shelves, you know, and I feel like sometimes as a culture, we're very invested in getting a recommendation for something or making sure that other people like something or we know that it's been sort of vetted, but there's so much fun in that joy of discovery and sort of like...
Yeah. Like browsing at your desk, how exciting is that?
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
That's
yeah.
just so cool. So you have our first book, right?
Yep. Yeah. I have the first book, which is called Winning the Earthquake, How Jeanette Rankin Defied All Odds to Become the First Woman in Congress. And the author is Larissa Reinhart, who is a historian. There's a book that captured my interest when I saw it, came across my desk, I cataloged it, and I had not heard of Jeanette Rankin before. And I was a history major in college, which probably speaks to what was being taught in history when I went to college. Well, Jeanette Rankin was a pioneer in women's suffrage and also a lifelong... pacifist, peace activist. She was born in 1880 on a ranch in Montana and grew up on the ranch. And long enough ago that she actually heard ranch hands talking about their experiences in the Civil War.
Oh, wow.
So she has a life that went from 1880 to 1973. So she's hearing Civil War veterans as a child, and then she's marching for civil rights with Coretta Scott King in the late 60s. So quite an amazing life.
You know, you just think about how young our country is and how much has happened in 250 years. And just to, like, that is such a, that's like a golden nugget to me of history to be able to. To have witnessed that be able to talk about
to live 93 years and see so many changes.
And, geez, if anybody's working on their America 250 list, that one would fit
all
over the place.
It's on the list, I think.
Yeah.
One of them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So she worked on the ranch with her parents, and she learned from an early age that it didn't matter what gender you were. Everyone had to pitch in on the ranch. There were no gender distinctions. It was like, you know, one for all. And she carried that for the rest of her life, really. She went to the University of Montana, Got a Bachelor of Science in Biology, but she was always kind of restless in college. She ended up becoming a teacher when she graduated, which was, you know, of course, one of the few jobs that women could get then, even with a college degree, but she was even restless in that. So she quit teaching and started working with the poor in Seattle and San Francisco. And I think seeing the struggles that women were having, in particular young, you know, mothers, single mothers, kind of led her towards the suffrage movement. And so she worked in various states working in women's suffrage, eventually leading her into a political career. So she was elected to the U.S. Congress in 1916, and she was just a tireless worker. I mean, she was tireless in promoting women's suffrage. She learned to drive. She had a driver's license. She drove all over the place in campaigning to be in the U.S. Congress. And that was when her pacifism really sort of showed itself. She voted against U.S. involvement in World War I, although she supported the war once the U.S. did enter the war. But her steadfast work as a pacifist really kind of torpedoed her political career for a while. So worked in women's suffrage. She introduced legislation that ended up becoming the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. In later years, she became fascinated with India and in their independence movement. And as I mentioned before, she worked for the civil rights movement, marching with Coretta Scott King. And her attitudes toward race evolved too. I mean, she'd be the first to admit that she had the sort of standard views towards blacks and Native Americans that a lot of white people did in the early 20th century, but her ideas evolved, her thoughts evolved. She realized the error of her ways, which I think is, you know, pretty amazing, pretty good of her to do that. And it's just an amazing life. And it's very highly readable book. It's not dry in any way whatsoever.
Okay.
And glad I read it.
Cool.
Very cool.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that a lot of us, maybe some of our listeners had heard of her, but I certainly hadn't. Maybe the name rang some bell.
The name, but that's not but necessarily that's to be able to place her. And that, again, speaks to our history educations that at least the group of us had.
It's pretty murky.
Yeah. And honestly, in a lot of classes, we didn't even get that far forward. And, you know,
you're
breezing through World War I up.
Sort of relegated to women's studies courses, maybe, at least in the 80s.
Yeah.
So I have to mention that when I found this book in January, stuff that was going on in the headlines politically, it just had me really down. And this is just such a kind of life-affirming book in a way.
Right.
Like, it gives you hope that, mm-hmm. you know, that things can change,
mm-hmm.
that
yeah.
people can individually work towards, you know, making the world a better place. So it's a real affirming kind of book to read.
Excellent. Oh, that sounds so good. Very good and perfect for the 250. And I love these stories of reclaiming history that really should be known, but isn't.
Yes.
And that's the part that I like the best about the 250 is those kinds of stories, mm-hmm. you know, is the examining or going under the surface of what that timeline of history that we're sort of taught, the mm-hmm. basic timeline. Well, I have the next book, which is also a nonfiction book. It's called Keeper of My Kin, a memoir of an immigrant daughter by Ada Ferrer. And she was the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Cuba, an American History. Mm-hmm. And this is a 2026 book, And it was just one of those memoirs that was just so beautifully crafted. I want to say that. It's just so, like, perfectly written. It's so solid and just really a pleasure to read, although the topic wasn't always a pleasure. You know, that's not really, that wouldn't be a good word for the content, really. But just this learning experience that I had reading this book was really strong. So Ada Ferrer came to the United States in 1963. She fled with her mother and father. And at that time, her mother had a child from another, from a first marriage, and she was unable to take them, her mother, Ada's brother, who was 9 years old at the time. So he stayed behind with relatives in Cuba. And that story is in the beginning of the book and really forms the heart of what sort of happens further out. And it's at its heart, it's a story of family separation, which, even though this is one story of one woman's experience, one family's experience, it's a story of so many people's experience right now throughout history, right? So it really personalizes that story of separation, of family separation, of immigration, of exile from one's homeland, even if it was felt necessary for safety, for saving one's life, for saving one's family, the loss. And so all of those themes echo throughout this book. And I love the title because it's perfect, Keeper of My Kin, because she is a professor at Princeton University of History, and she is an archivist and that sort of thing. And she went back many times to write this book into archives, going back with family, but also went through her family's letters. Her dad was sort of a secret writer, all of his letters. And so in a way, it's perfect because she was sort of the keeper of the family stories in the sense that she pulls them out through genealogy, through work. So it's at once a memoir. It's her story, but it's also a family story. And not just of her, but of the brother who was left behind, who had an extremely tragic life, and of her mother's devotion and her devotion to that brother, even though he was dangerous and difficult. And then of another secret brother. But that's, I won't go into the whole story because it's, you really got to read the book to experience it. But it's just such an evocative look at what happens when people have to leave their homeland. And in particular, her father, for his whole life, wrote letters and wrote these, you know, pieces that he wasn't really showing anybody. But some of them were letters to Fidel Castro, you know, about having to leave. He didn't send them, but about that feeling. And, you know, he remade a life here. They ate Cuban dinner every single night. They lived in Miami. They lived in New York. But it was never quite the same as being back home. So, and she visits Cuba many times, and that's very interesting too.
Yeah,
so.
It would be. Yeah.
Yeah.
That one sounds so interesting to
me. Yeah, it really. I thought of Jessica because of genealogy and her dedication to uncovering the stories, going way back of her ancestors, and it's just really fascinating. Yep. So.
Very cool. We're actually in the kind of nonfiction run here. I actually very, very quickly want to note that I finished Mother Tongue by Sarah Novitch after Cheryl talked about it last podcast episode. So I just want to doubly say, please go read it. I sort of went back and forth between reading the book and actually listening to the audio, and I really find the audio was fascinating because where they set sign off in the text of the book, you hear the audio of the sign in the audiobook, which is actually quite an interesting experience.
Wow.
Especially when you're talking about deaf culture and deafness and sign. And it's just it was an interesting choice and a very interesting thing. So it's different. Mind you, if you drop in, if you've been reading the book and then go into the audiobook, you do wonder what's going on in terms of the sound in the sound quality of it.
Okay.
Because if you miss the note at the beginning saying you're going to be hearing people do sign.
Oh, wow.
So it's actually quite an interesting choice to have made and it was very neat to listen to. But the book I really wanted to talk about is the one I'd kind of been teasing earlier. Because, and I didn't talk about it sooner because I kept losing the audiobook and was on the waiting list for the physical book. And that's The Story of Birds, A New History from Their Dinosaur Origins to the Present by Steve Brissetti. I loved this book. I listened to part of it, and I read the physical book. And I highly suggest getting a hold of the physical book for all the plates and family trees of dinosaurs and birds that are within it. It's fascinating. It was sort of, for me, the perfect bridge between our last year's one grand read, my bird fascination, and this year's summer reading with our Unearth a Story. It's with a lot of people jumping on the dinosaur part of the theme. It's just, and I think, I'm not sure at what point we started to hear, but it was in my childhood that you started to hear more often about, well, no, dinosaurs, birds are dinosaurs, or, you know, yeah. That sort of thing was coming across. And I'm thinking it was before the first Jurassic Park, not necessarily the book, but before the movie, that it was sort of coming out. Because I can remember a particular, and then they talk about him in the book, and I can't remember his name, but there was a particular archaeologist that they talked about, or that I would hear about, who made a point. And I think the character in Jurassic Park is partially based on him. But this is just, it's fascinating. This is Steve Brissetti is now a professor at, I think, University of Edinburgh. But he's an American researcher. He is very open about all the people he's worked with, and all the people who've come up with these different discoveries and led and solidified this family tree of dinosaurs to birds. It's fascinating to me that like my one big thought is that, well, obviously because there's pterodactyls, well, those aren't actually the direct descendants of birds. It's more like Tyrannosaurus Rex and Velociraptors and that line of dinosaurs. And it's just, it's fascinating to kind of hear about the development and what they have found and how early it actually happened, because it was something that was suggested much earlier on and then just sort of in the Darwin period, but there wasn't the evidence that they needed to actually solidify that until later. You weren't finding anything with feathers on it yet in that period where they actually eventually started getting to the point where they were actually finding specimens with feathers. So Wow. It's just, it's fascinating. It's fascinating to listen about the discoveries, the variety of techniques used to make all these discoveries, the things that it talks about, how birds adapt. So like can be like very, very quickly or very, very slowly. It depends. I mean, there are things that have died out because of mostly our influence, that can't adapt as quickly, but other things have managed to work around us and truly adapt and can adapt over just a generation even. So there's so much information in this. It is a really good listen. It's a very good read. On top of that, there's so many notes and ideas for other reading in it too. So
And I want to throw out there, he has written several other books that are just equally fascinating sounding to me.
He's all over that nonfiction list.
He really is. He dominates the list for good reason. Very cool.
He's well written. They're technical, but they're not. I mean, they're easy reads, and he explains things very well.
Wow. I mean, that's so awesome in and of itself. Someone who's that talented who also can write and explain things in a way that doesn't throw the book into that, oh, it's boring, it's nonfiction kind of category.
And it doesn't feel like the ego's there. He really feels like he's giving equal time to his mentors, his people who inspired him, people who he's worked with, students he's worked with, you know. Oh. So it's cool.
Well, speaking of T-Rex, I have a complimentary book, maybe. How Dinosaurs Became the Birds We Know Today, Chickens and Other Dinosaurs. This is by Ben Lorwell and Sarah Edmonds. And I have to tell you that, I mean, I wish I could show it to our listeners.
Yeah.
This is just a stunning picture book, nonfiction book. It was the cover that really got me. You've got the dinosaur and the chicken right there. And it's very beautifully illustrated, but so packed with so much information, like just even starting with like birds and how, you know, they really are so valuable to our whole environment, you know, the bugs eating, bugs kind of are eaten so that, you know, we don't get totally overrun by bugs. And just, you know, how they really are really important in showing us when something's wrong in our environment, because you start seeing them either get really sick or dying off, and just it's so interesting. But I really like this title because there are a lot of things, like I didn't realize that you know, it says meet the family is a spread where it says, did you hear about the chicken that was related to the T-Rex? I didn't know. It's kind of like not all dinosaurs, right? Like what you just said.
Right.
It sounds like from a joke, but it's really a fact is what Ben Lerwell says. And, you know, they gave this example of digging up a T-Rex thigh bone and they cut into it and just were able to kind of trace it back to the you know, the kind of things you see in a chicken, the proteins in the strands.
Absolutely.
It was really, really interesting. I really liked also how, you know, they kind of brought back the fact that, you know, dinosaurs are eggs, or came from eggs, and just like birds, right? And they weren't all, you know, perfectly round. You know, the book mentions that, well, actually they could be more like a baguette style. It was just really, really neat. I would highly recommend this book. And I want to also mention that it's, you know, 50 pages or so, but it's also set up in terms of like a chapter system. So it's got, you know, the contents lays out. So you could easily read this either in a night or a couple nights if you want to read this with your child. I just thought it was really, really interesting and beautifully illustrated.
Yep. And I will say, Brissetti points out that, you know, dinosaurs still rule the earth. They're still
basically
birds outnumber us purely based on our cooking and food production. There are more birds, there are more chickens around than
and just the fact that they've been around way longer than we have.
We need them.
And
I'll never forget a baguette egg now. That's going to be in my head.
Absolutely.
I'm imagining a baguette dinosaur egg.
They're just fascinating. It's just fascinating.
What a cool book. You know, I'm so glad we have so many more books like this, because I remember, you know, starting out in libraries and little kids wanting dinosaur books, and you had some more than other topics probably, but not enough.
Yeah, and speaking of, you will allow me to recommend I Used to Be a Dinosaur. That's by Casey Lyle. That just came out. Illustrated by Michigan-based Lori Keller. Lena the Chicken, But Really a Dinosaur, that's by Linda Bailey. And then here's another nonfiction book going way back to 1981, Chickens Aren't the Only Ones, a book about animals that lay eggs, and that's by Ruth Heller. These just fascinating, like so many like very digestible books for kids to learn about the history of dinosaurs.
And, cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Okay, well, I guess maybe I'm kind of sort of continuing at least an animal theme this next book, though not dinosaurs. We're going to fiction now, and this book is called The Good Animal by Sarah Maurer. And I saw this book come across my desk and noticed that the setting was Sault Ste. Marie in Chippewa County. And I had never, ever seen a book with that setting in my life.
Okay.
I thought, I've got to put a hold on this, just based on the setting alone. So I did so, and when I checked out the book, I was already reading something else at the time, so I put it aside for, it was a 7-day hold. I think I put it aside for 6 days, thinking, oh boy, I'm probably not going to get to this book. But I finished the book that I was on, and I thought, okay, I'm going to give this book, A Good Animal, a try. If it doesn't stick after the first 10 pages, I'm going to just bring it back to the library and before the due date. But I'm happy to report that those first 10 pages were great, and I read the book in about 3 days. It is a book that is narrated by a 17-year-old boy or young man named Everett Lintz. He lives on a sheep farm just outside of Sault Ste. Marie in Chippewa County with his family. His life revolves around the sheep farm, raising the sheep, taking them to the county fair, selling them. And it's kind of an insulated life, basically sort of dominated by his family, until he meets a girl, an artistic newcomer named Mary Williams, who has just moved to Sault Ste. Marie with her father, who's in the Coast Guard. So she's kind of the, maybe you could call her a Coast Guard brat rather than an Army brat. She's kind of moved around, and she's not too thrilled with having to live in the Sioux. But, you know, I think they mentioned her bouncing around several different places throughout her youth, and it's just yet another stop that she has to make with her father. But she meets Charlie, or not Charlie. Charlie is Everett's friend. I'm sorry. She meets Everett, and Everett's kind of introverted, and he's just fascinated with her, and they develop a friendship, which ends up becoming a romantic, a little bit more romantic. But complications ensue, pretty serious complications that I won't go into. You'll have to read the book to find out about that. But overall, I really enjoyed the portrayal of rural life, country life. I identified more with Mary, who was more of a city slicker. I lived in the Thumb from age 10 to 18 and was much more of a city, felt like more of a city kid, but I had enough. It's almost inevitable that you're going to end up being on a farm or maybe working a little bit on a farm. Or in my case, I worked at the county fairgrounds for a couple summers. And the one thing I always noticed about the country kids, and this kind of comes through in this book, is that they don't notice the smells of the farms. They don't notice the poop. nothing fazes them. And I remember going to visit friends of mine who lived on farms thinking, oh man, it smells so nasty here. How did they not notice this? Sarah Moore did a really good job in portraying that. And also just the kind of stuff like just aimlessly driving on country roads when you're a teenager and drinking cheap beer and, going to the county fair and stuff that happens there. It was just a very authentic view of country life. And, fire pits in the backyard, just hanging out with your friends with a fire going and hanging around.
So I read this book, too. Absolutely stunning. And I read somebody say it was brutal, and I completely agree. It was just so, it was gorgeous in that, there was so much talk of the land and the animals and the life cycles. And there was also just like so many like tiny snippets of the relationships with the families and the other people who live in the town. It was just beautiful. And I have not been to the Sioux in many like decades. And now I'm like, I want to go. I want to drive around. Uh-huh. It was just a really gorgeous book, and I recommend it as well.
Yeah, it's so good. And it's so, like you said, it's so well written, and it's told from Everett's point of view. And I felt compelled to email Sarah Moore and tell her how much I liked the book. But also I told her I pictured this book being written by Everett years later, maybe 20 years later. This book takes place in the 90s, I should mention that. Because it's so well written and so literate and so lyrical. And Everett in the book is always talking about, I'm in the dumb kid English class. Yeah. And I'm thinking, this kid is such a great, if he's looking back on his life and he's writing his memoirs, he's turned into a great writer. So I wrote to Sarah saying, I pictured him as like going back to college maybe or whatever, 20 years later, maybe taking like a creative writing class and this being part of his creative writing class. And she was kind enough to say that she loved my view of what the adult Everett could have been like. and relating the story of his teen years. And yeah, like you said, the end of the book is pretty, it's pretty rough, and I don't want to get into it. It's pretty intense.
Yeah.
But anything more than that would be a spoiler. So I want people to read this book and find out for for themselves.
Love on Michigan. Oh, this was just awesome. Something I will remember for many, many moons.
I guess this will be a Michigan Notable Book contender for sure.
I would think so.
Contender, I hope so.
At least. Yeah. Very cool. Thank you. That one sounds so good. And it ties in well to my next book, which is called Mare, a novel by Emily Haworth Booth. And this is one where I saw that it was coming. Did you tell me about it? I don't know. I saw it somewhere. Oh, I saw about it on Instagram because I follow a lot of authors. And she's a British author. And so it got published in England first.
Yeah.
So I was waiting and waiting and waiting and finally got picked up here. So I had to wait quite a while. And then it sat in technical services on the carts. It didn't have a lot of holds. And they just kept sitting there. And the cover is so beautiful. It's just like the script of the word mare, but there's like a tail on the M. So it kind of looks like a horse. It's probably like the prettiest cover of the year to me.
It's got a real kind of old school look to it. Like it's from the 60s or something.
So I'm like, of course I'm just going to love this book. So I check it out and then I instantly went and bought it. I have to say, I use the library all the time, but sometimes I buy a book right away because I'm like, I need this book. I want to give the author the royalty, whatever. Making a long story short, this is just a really introspective, really creatively written, unique novel about a woman. She's married. She has a dog. The dog passes away. It was kind of like her baby. And she is in this phase of her life where everybody's having children around her. And she's interested in having children. But because of medical reasons, she has like an early menopause, essentially, and quite early, and cannot have children. And it's hard because she wanted to. And so she's sort of going through all this. She doesn't have the dog. She's a writer, and she writes these books for children. But she's writing one. It's almost like from a textbook about plastics. And so she's like, okay, I'm writing this book about plastic. And so she has to go and write this book. And it's funny. There's passages. It's one of those books where you're in her head, and she's just telling you what's going on. So life is just kind of in this weird holding pattern. It's not going great. And she's just feeling like, I'm writing a book about plastic. I don't know where I'm going with things right now. I'm really stuck. I've got these health problems. I got to go to the doctor a lot. So she gets this opportunity to lease a horse. And it's like a share thing. And she's like, okay, I can do that. And so she signs up for it. And that's just basically where the book takes you. And again, I'm not going to tell you more too much because that's the beauty of the book. I do have a few little things I'd like to read because in real life, she is a horse lover. And I love it when a horse book is written by a person who knows horses. This book is like, I wanted to shout, yes, 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 all the time. It was so relatable. And it's really about the love of the horse, which sounds cheesy and cliche, but it's like, no, horse love is something very different. It just is, you know, it's so powerful. And just a few things just cover this life at the barn is what this one is. There are almost 50 horses here, each attached to their own human female. Walking into the yard, there is nothing to see but horses and women. Women washing feed bowls, women sweeping, women hosing buckets, women pushing wheelbarrows, women carrying hay nuts, and bags of wood chips and bins of chaff. So that's just one. A little bit about horse obsession, which is a total thing, and that's a little bit what this book is about. Okay. I knew a woman who once told me that when she was a girl, the sight of a horse was thought to trigger in her an ungovernable flow of passion, a kind of mania. And so every time the family car passed a field of horses, her siblings did their best to make sure she did not see them. They pulled her below the window, pressed her face against the back of the car seat, blindfolded her with whatever was to hand, a scarf, a sweatshirt. This happened on her parents' instruction. It became, over time, a family joke. I think of the girl now as I stand looking at the horse, waiting for someone to stop me. So on that note, I'm going to end it, but I'm talking about the book, but I do want to say, if you're a horse person listening, you know this. If you're not a horse person, there's something called a mare person. There are people who love mares. I am one of those people, so this is my book of the year and my book for my heart. But mare people are unique. And there's gelding people, which is most people are gelding people. Mare people like the mare. The mare is more challenging. The mare is, you got to work with a mare. You can't tell a mare what to do. So it's just, this book really touches on that. And I love that. And I did write to the author also through Instagram.
That's cool.
And I was like, I'm a mare person too. I get it. And it's just, it's a unique thing. I mean, a mare, I have a big bruise on my shin right now from my mare kicking me this week. So, you know, mares are mares. And it's so cool to center a whole book around that love of a mare in particular, because it's just special. So, all right.
Wow.
That's mare.
Great.
All right.
Cool.
So, very loosely, I don't know how many people, I want to talk about Whistler by Ann Patchett. I don't know if you've seen the cover for that, but it is a horse on the cover of that one. And there is sort of horse imagery throughout, and there's a story that kind of is an underlying kind of part of the story as well. But mostly I just want to come back to, this is Ann Patchett's latest novel. This is loosely personal in the sense that she is somebody who grew up with multiple parents, step-parents. This is a book that opens with a woman named Daphne and her husband wandering through the Met in New York. And her husband's sort of saying, there's a guy following us. And she's just not concerned. She's just enjoying it. And he's like, nope, we're going to go this way. He's still following us. Do you know who he is? Can you? And it's just, he's seems to be more anxious about it. And she's really laid back about the whole thing. She's just, what do you think is going to happen? It's an old man. She ends up sort of stopping in front of, and he's just kind of going on about it. And she ends up stopping in front of a piece that I would like to know if it exists. I just don't know. But it's a, it is a piece of a horse and sort of the shadow of a horse that is totally enthralls her. But he's still talking about the person following them. And it's like, do you know who he is? And all this sort of stuff. Finally, the guy approaches them. And it is her middle stepfather. So if you had a father, her mother, they divorced. Her mother remarried this man, Eddie. And then that relationship ended in elementary school, and then her mother later remarried a third man, so second, and that's the person her mother is still with. But Eddie was probably the best parent she had of all of her parents. So she's not, I mean, when she realizes who he is, she just wants, they both want to reconnect. They're sort of each other's people in a way. I mean, if there was a, if he was going to have a child, this was the child of his heart. And it was a very, very sudden break in terms of their marriage. And it was tied around something that happened to the pair of them. And the story is a slow unfolding of them getting to know each other, but also a better understanding of what happened in her childhood. Because he was sort of there and then he wasn't. And it might have been, you know, it, as a child looking at it, it's like, was it because of something I did? Was it because of what happened and it wasn't his fault? What happened? And it is a slow rollout of what happened in her childhood. What was the things that she, the pieces that she missed? What were the parts that she has a sister who's a child psychologist. I can't remember if she's a child psychologist or not, but you know, her sister has, she and her sister are very close. They have half-siblings. Their actual father, their biological father, has died, which is how she met her husband, who was a hospital administrator at the hospital where her father was. So it's a slow, interesting book. I haven't read a lot of Patchett's fiction, actually. But I did read Tom Lake, and it is in the sense of the storytelling, the mother telling the story. Yeah. This is a little bit more, you're getting it from different pieces. You get her mother, you know, she eventually goes back to her mother and starts asking questions. She asks Eddie questions. Her sister's asking her questions because she doesn't know part of the story because the sort of the events begin with her sister having appendicitis and being in the hospital, and then sort of the things that happen around this lead to this break that she, you know, she sort of blocked out in a sense, because after a point she and her sister just had to be there for each other with all the changes happening in their lives and sort of the weird relationships they have with their other extra parents. So it's just, it's a slow, interesting read, and I really liked the characters. So I would suggest it.
Sounds really good.
Yeah. And there is a interesting horse story. As a non-horse person, who's always been had horse people on the side, I don't know what Ann Patchett's relationship with horses are, but there is, it's such a theme. I hadn't even quite realized how much of a theme there is of horse stories within this.
This makes me think about these precious days. We'll put it in the show notes. Her essay collection.
Yes.
She has an essay collection. I don't remember completely, but something like My Three Dads.
Yeah.
And there's this really powerful essay about her real life, all her dads, stepdads. And there's a picture of her with them at some function with all of them together.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll put that in the show notes too, but I really want to read this.
Yeah.
I'm hearing like nothing but good about this book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just like so much love.
It's just that, it's people finding the truth, people discuss, you know, actually talking and kind of explaining what happened and finding comfort and still having, you know, building relationships afterwards. It's really quite neat.
Cool.
So. Well, my book, next book, does not have any horses in it.
That's okay.
But I'm sort of a wannabe horse person. I have ridden many times, but still would consider myself a very beginner level person. But thank you, Cheryl and Jessica, for those two recommendations. I would like to read both of them. Wow. I have Landslide by Betty Cully. This is a children's chapter book, perfect, I would say, for a fourth grader, fifth grader. Nathan Savage is 10 years old. He lives in a rural part of Maine. And 3 years ago, guess what moved in across the street? A garbage dump. His mother is really upset to the point where, like, she keeps the shades closed all the time. She works at night, so she doesn't have to think or see or hear all the work that's being done on the garbage dump across the street. And his father, in need of a better job for many years, takes a job there. So his commute is really short. It's right across the street. Something about Nathan is that he's got what he calls his special eyesight. He thinks that he can see subtle movements everywhere. He can always tell when something is about to happen just based on the visuals. There are protesters at the dump, and one of the protesters has a young brother who is living with his older sister, maybe because the mom is absent because of mental health or a substance. I mean, just not there, but Wilder is this friend that Nathan meets, and they learn a lot about garbageology is what they call it. So they share tidbits and factoids, and they develop a plan so that if there's ever an emergency, because Nathan is really, you know, pretty sure that something is happening over there because he keeps noticing these subtle changes. Sure enough, one day there's something that activates the plan. I won't tell you what Wilder does, but Nathan, who is the son, ends up on that dump to try to warn off someone who is working there. And eventually something happens. The dump collapses, and there's a landslide. This is based on true events that happened in Maine in 1989. Cully does such a fascinating job of just like giving you short chapters and building the story of what happens. I also have to say, I read this on my Kindle and just looked at the cover actually today. It's by Christy. Please forgive my mispronunciation, Red Willowitz. Wow, what a gorgeous cover. I mean, it just really gives you that perfect picture of this beautiful home, and across the street, a big old garbage dump. And it just really makes you think a lot about environmental things and, you know, what do we do with our waste, and who has to handle it? Who has to see it? Who has to smell it? Because there's an incredible smell. After World War II, that's when we really, really, really started getting stuff in the U.S. and maybe around the world. And these landslides on garbage dumps have happened multiple times all over the world. So, this is really, really fascinating. And I do think children, especially who are interested in environmental things, you know, want to think about how we care for the earth and how, you know, how our surroundings kind of affect us, would really be interested in this. So
that really makes me think about like zoning laws and some real bad things that are done with zoning and placing certain people of certain economic groups really close to sites that they shouldn't be close to. A couple books that just jumped in my head.
Yeah.
The Yellow House by Sarah Broom and Elizabeth Rush. I'll put it in the show notes. I just blanked out on the title. Rising. It's about water, but it's about how sometimes communities are, there's very loose zoning laws about dumps and about even, you know, being so close to flooded areas and that sort of thing. And
isn't there also a new memoir out by garbage?
Is that? The garbage, the French garbage truck driver? Is that what you're thinking of?
Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember the name of it right now, but we can put that in the notes too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was, I feel sad that if I presented this as a too serious book, there's so much good. I just love the relationships between Wilder and the relationship between Wilder and Nathan, because Wilder is this kid who perhaps is on the spectrum in some way. He's got alopecia. He's bullied. But he's so smart, and he is so interested in just conservation and just really getting at the root of what could be serious problems. So it's really like both of those characters.
How unique.
I think you're going to have our last
two,
Mark.
You're our last one, Mark.
I have a couple of books, I guess, to end with. Before I forget, I want to thank you for having me on the podcast. It's an honor and a privilege, as always.
Love having you on.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So these final two books are fiction, and for some reason, I can't explain why, I've read more fiction this year than I have in many years.
This is a conversation Cheryl and I have often.
Yeah.
It's the reverse. I read more nonfiction, she reads more fiction.
Funny. Yeah, there's no real explanation for it. It's just I've seen a lot of interesting fiction books come across my desk. So the first one I'm going to talk about is called The Monuments of Paris by Violaine Huysmans. And my apologies to any French speakers out there if I got the pronunciation wrong or a little off. I once again saw this come across my desk and it looked interesting. Since I've been in Paris the previous year, so I've still got Paris on my mind a year later. So the setting really kind of grabbed me. But when I started it, I was a little worried that it wasn't going to stick. Made it halfway through, and I thought, I don't know about this book. This might be a book I don't finish. But the second half of the book was much better. I'm probably not really selling this book very well by saying that the first half was boring or something, but it just didn't quite stick with me. But by the second half, I was completely in. It's a semi-fictional exploration of Violaine's father, Denise Huysmans, and her grandfather, Georges Huysmans. The book really picks up in the second half when she switches from her father, who's kind of a philanderer, and he's sort of a philosopher, but he's really more of a, I think he's got kind of a racket making textbooks, I guess, like philosophy textbooks. He published philosophy textbooks and is like selling philosophy courses for students. And I, didn't really quite jive with them or groove with them. It really wasn't until she started talking about her grandfather, Georges, who came from a fairly humble background but ended up rising in the French Department of Fine Arts and actually was a founder of the Cannes Film Festival.
Wow.
But her grandfather was in exile during World War II and went to Algeria. There's parts of the book that kind of read like Casablanca, the movie Casablanca, escape trying to run away from the Nazis.
Wow.
And the second half of the book was quite compelling. And it ended up leading me to her, Violaine's previous book called The Book of Mother, where she talks about her mother's life. And I have to be honest, that's a book that I actually liked even more than The Monuments of Paris. Once again, not really selling this book that well, but it's really good.
Yeah,
it's kind
good.
Of written in a real... It's,
it sounds good.
It's written in that kind of non-fussy way that French writers tend to have, you know, just sort of very matter-of-fact. Kind of remind me of Camus in a way.
Okay.
And I guess if this were published originally in the U.S., it might be more of a considered a memoir, but I guess from my understanding in Europe... In France, you can blend memoir with fiction and just basically consider it a novel, I guess. So anyway, that would be The Monuments of Paris. So I like that book. And so my second book, we're going from Paris to England, and this is called The Palm House by Gwendolyn Riley. This is a book where I have to admit I saw the cover of it, which featured a black and white photo of two rather long, shapely legs. It made it look like it was some kind of steamy pot boiler. I thought, okay, that's interesting.
I mean, yes, you have to see the cover
of
this.
Yeah, the cover is, it's like, what is that about?
Yeah, and it has nothing to do with the book at all. I don't know why they chose that cover.
To get people's attention.
Yeah.
There's no question about that.
You got to do something.
The book is much less glamorous than that. It's about Laura Miller, who's a 40-something magazine editor trying to make it in modern London. And... her friend and co-worker, Edmund, who's in his 50s, and just various other odd people in her life. Not a lot happens in the book, but the characters are so well drawn that is really the best part of the book, I think. Riley has kind of a spare writing style that it never manipulates your emotions. She's a really good observer of people and all their eccentricities and messiness. And I suppose the overarching theme of the book would be Laura sort of continually having to put up with all these people in her lives with their hang-ups and their messiness. I don't know. I enjoyed the book enough that I went back and read her book from 2021 called My Phantoms, which is basically about family dysfunction, but it's just really good. And a book that I enjoyed even more than The Palm House. So don't know that I'm really selling The Palm House.
I think you did okay.
But it's very good. Yeah. It's very good. I would suggest people just give it a shot and see what they think of it, if any of what I said sounds the slightest bit interesting.
No, the Palm House, I've seen it around, like, talked about a lot.
Different things.
Yeah, it looks, they both sound really
good.
Yeah,
I'm absolutely certain I had to add for Holtz for that one recently. So, there are people talking about it already.
Good.
You sound great.
Yeah. All right. So that's a wide-ranging set of titles this time. And thank you, Mark, for joining us. It is a pleasure to have you on.
Yeah,
thank
it
you.
Really is.
And everybody, go read more. Enjoy your summer reading. And see you next time.
All right.
Happy reading.
Happy reading.